Hey, this is Matt Hawkins, and you're listening to the Top Cow Chronology Project.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Top Cow Chronology Project. I'm your host, Jace. It's Thursday, and that means it's time for Top Cow. This is another Top Cow Chronology Project episode. And for those not familiar, the Top Cow Chronology Project is something Manny and I started with the intention of reading all of the comics in the Top Cow Artifact universe. So that shared superhero slash supernatural universe, if you will, started with the title Witchblade. But the reading order we're following, which was created by a user who goes by the name of Condor over on the Comic Vine website, it's a chronological reading order, not a publishing reading order. So what that means is the first books in the reading order are the books that take place in ancient times, right? Ancient Egypt, and then moves forward in time to present day and on into the future. So that has bearing on the books I'm going to talk about in today's podcast, because since neither Manny nor I, we'd always wanted to read the Top Cow Artifact Universe stuff, Witchblade, Darkness, Magdalena, Artifacts, all that stuff, and never had. And so we thought, okay, this is a great way to do it. We'll read the books and then immediately record a podcast about our reaction to those particular issues. One issue per podcast, for the most part. The thing was, since neither one of us had ever read anything and Witchblade came first, we decided when we started the podcast to do the first volume of Witchblade, even though it wasn't the first in the reading order, just to kind of give ourselves some context. So now we're at the point, so the first 8 episodes of the Top Cow Chronology Project are that first volume of Witchblade. But now we're at the, and then we went and followed the reading order. But now we're at the point where Witchblade numbers 1 through 8 actually show up in the chronology. So I was kind of torn, like, so what do we want to do? Do we want to go and read the issues again one by one and give our reactions again, even though they aren't our first initial reactions? Do we want to just re-release the old podcasts, just basically, put them out as new episodes? But they're still available on the website, so I didn't really want to do that. And I didn't want to do another 8 episodes individually for issues 1 through 8 of Witchblade. So what I decided to do is break it up into 2. So went and back and reread issues 1 through 8 of Witchblade, and then reread again issues 1 through 4. So I'll be talking about issues 1 through 4 on today's podcast. And then next week, or next time I do a Top Cow Chronology, we'll do issues 4 to 8, just so we still cover them and give our thoughts. But if you really want to go issue by issue of a breakdown of those particular issues, then I encourage you to go back and listen to those very first 8 podcast episodes of the Top Cow Chronology Project, keeping in mind that our equipment wasn't as good back then. It was when we first started, and I haven't gone back to listen to those either, so I'm not sure. Manny was, when we were talking about what we were going to do with these Witchblade issues, he was like, man, I was so green back then. I don't know that I was any good with what I was saying or whatever, but I mean, I have no idea if he's gone back and listened to them either, but it might be interesting. So anyway, they're there if you want to go back and listen to our initial reactions. But I'm basically going to do kind of a lightning round, if you will. Usually in a Chronology Project issue, what I'll do is I'll give a synopsis of the issue and then I'll talk in depth about different things. So about that particular issue. So I'm going to do the same thing here, but I'm going to cover 4 issues. So it's not going to be as in depth as it usually is. It's going to be more broad, the big plot points that happen, and then a few things that that I noticed about the issue, and obviously the analysis isn't going to be as in-depth as it was the first time around because I'm not talking about every story beat. So we start off with Witchblade number one, the creative team, co-plotters David Wall and Brian Haberlin, script by David Wall with Christina Z, pencils and co-plotter Michael Turner, who, I mean, that's the reason I got interested in Witchblade in the first place is because Michael Turner, you know, my favorite comic artist of all time. The inks are by D-Tron and the colors are by J.D. Smith and Nathan Cabrera. So this is the first issue of Witchblade, the one that started it all off. And it actually starts, we meet a man named Kenneth Irons. We learn through exposition that he's an entrepreneur and owns Irons International, which is a Fortune 500 company, and all this kind of stuff. So interesting that the story starts off with a guy that most people probably have never heard of, even, you know, as Witchblade played out for well over 100 issues. But right away, you're struck with the amazing art of Michael Turner, the attention to detail. He's looking out these windows of this penthouse. There's a chandelier. There's a lot of detail in his tie. It's just incredible. Then he moves on to a room where he's clearly collected some works of art. Again, super detailed, you know, that style of art with the clean lines and all the detail that Michael Turner is really known for. And he clearly has something going on with a treasure, something that's covered, and there's a lot of ominous overtones, I guess. Next, we switch to an apartment where a woman's getting dressed, and this is where we meet Sarah Pizzini for the first time. And again, this is a little bit of its time in that there's a lot of dialogue, or not dialogue even, but a lot of exposition, a lot of dialogue boxes that are really telling this story rather than just letting the art tell a story like it usually happens in more modern day books. So once the woman gets dressed, she goes to an apartment. Apparently there's a bunch of drug dealers there. At this point, we're not 100% sure, you know, who she is. Is she a cop? Is she not? You get the idea that she's a cop. And, you know, in that typical drug dealer fashion or crime boss fashion, I guess you'd say, they want her to hurt somebody, kill somebody, do something beyond what a normal police officer would do to kind of prove that she's not, you know, that she'll break the law, prove that she's not a cop. Oh, and I should mention that Witchblade 1 came out in November of 1995. So, of course, Sarah's not about to shoot somebody else, which later we find out is actually her partner is the one who's kind of undercover, and the turns out the drug dealers know that he's a cop, but instead of shooting him, she pistol whips him and then breaks into action. And this was something I didn't hit me the first time that I read the book initially, was just how athletic and capable of kind of a hand-to-hand combatant Sarah Pizzini is, even before she gets the Witchblade. It really struck me. So I was like, whoa, I don't know that I noticed that the first time. So anyway, come to find out, Sarah was not really authorized to go in there and do what she did. So her boss, her captain at the station, we learn that that's kind of a father-son relationship. He worries about her. We also learn that part of the reason Sarah did what she did was because a friend of hers was killed by those drug dealers while she was just out for a walk with her small child. So right away, it establishes compassion with the character. Next, we meet Nottingham, who appears to be the right-hand man of Kenneth Irons' character that we met early on in the story. And there seems to be something going on at this old theater where he's having some kind of an event, and we know that he's brought that whatever that treasure, whatever that antiquity was that was covered in his kind of trophy/art room. And he talks about knowing that the winner is out among the people that are paying to go into the theater and try to win something, I guess. It's not 100% really clear. I mean, they call it a prize. Not really sure. Then We have an interlude where Sarah is actually on her next official case, and she goes to a crime scene where a woman is kneeling, her head thrown back, and basically they say she's cooked from the inside out. So really strange. Next, we see Sarah with her partner, Michael Yee. You know, they got a tip from an informant, something going on at the Rialto Theater, which is the theater, of course, where Irons and Nottingham are about to have their event, whatever it's called. So Sarah wants to know what's going on. Why did these people, you know, these drug dealers were trying to raise money so they could get an entrance fee to this contest? Anything to do with this one particular drug dealer, Sarah's, you know, it automatically gets her, piques her interest, and she wants to know what's going on because she thinks the guy's just scum of the earth, basically. And as I said, killed her friend. So as the event's about to start, Nottingham lifts the cloth on this artifact, and we see a gauntlet there with a few gems in it. And that is, of course, is the Witchblade. And so it's basically, pay your fee, you get to come have a chance to be the bearer of the Witchblade. And I don't know that the people in the audience necessarily know what the Witchblade is all about, but we do know that Kenneth Irons is hoping that somebody will actually be able to wield this Witchblade. And his thought is he has some plan to either take that power from them or have some control over them so that he will, by proxy, wield the Witchblade himself. It's kind of the idea that you get. And the first guy that comes and tries basically has his hand, entire hand and forearm burned off by the device. Next page, Michael Yee's discovered sneaking in. Sarah had gone in as the, she pretended to be the girlfriend or acquaintance, if you will, of one of the guys that was going in. Escort, I guess you'd say, and then disappeared when she got inside to kind of spy. But when Yee is there and he's about to be shot, Sarah's not about to let that happen. She tries to save him, jumps in front of him. She's shot herself. The Witchblade falls to the floor of the stage. And as Sarah's there dying, she's reaching out for any weapon, knife, gun, what have you. And the Witchblade attaches to her. And we see that Kenneth Irons is very excited about that. Sarah is immediately overwhelmed by power. Fires out these blasts of energy. We see that she was not successful in saving Michael Yee. He dies there in her arms, and then Sarah kind of collapses, and the first issue ends. So one of the things I was struck by when I read through this again was, well, a few things. Michael Turner's art is just as amazing as always. There's a lot of exposition in the book, which is a little bit of its time, and at the same time, not, because there was a tendency in the mid-90s to go overboard with the splash pages and the art, and the story suffered. This is actually a really strong story and a little bit ahead of its time in that, you know, strong female lead. It's not a bad girl book as much as everybody used to say that it was, because the story, the dialogue, I mean, the dialogue can be a little bit dated at time with the references, but for the most part, even in the exposition, the scripting, the dialogue, it's pretty solid. It's a good story. It's a they're fleshed out characters. Sarah feels real. She doesn't feel like some kind of bimbo bad girl. So in that way, it was a little bit ahead of its time. But now comics have less dialogue, less, just fewer words. And so in that way, this is with so many words, and it is somewhat of a throwback to comics that came out even before the mid-90s, because I think in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s, that was when we really started getting away from so many words, so much dialogue and scripting. So in a way, this is almost a throwback to the comics of the mid-80s, as far as the, you know, amount of words and amount of text and kind of the storytelling style. But it's starting to bridge that gap where you're seeing the art tell the story more, which, you know, I have no problem with that because it's Michael Turner art, which is completely amazing. Also, the first time I read it, I feel like I thought it was going to completely blow me away. I thought it was going to be so good because having always wanted to read it, never having read it, Michael Turner art, friends with all the guys over at Top Cow, you know, it's a classic series. I mean, if you're a comic book fan, you've heard of Witchblade. It was around for a long time. So I guess maybe my expectations were a little bit too high. And so then when I read it the first time, it didn't totally blow me away. So, you know, the few times I've gone back and paged through it or read it again since then, I've come to appreciate it more for what it is. And it is a really strong story. And this first issue, I think, is a good start. So let me move on to issue two. We see that it starts out in a dance club, and there's another woman in that same pose, kneeling, head thrown back, completely frozen, clearly some serial killer going on. Then we switch back to the theater. Sarah's there. She has the gauntlet. She tries to remove it, and we see it kind of scrapes her forearm as she does remove it, and she kind of passes out. Next we see her. She's in the hospital. She's surrounded by her captain and other members of her precinct, and they're all worried about her. They tell her that her partner, you know, didn't make it, and she's going to need some time to recover. And there's basically an internal affairs person that we met briefly in the first issue who's waiting anxiously to ask her some questions as well. And we also get this idea that one of the other guys in her precinct, Jake, has a crush on her because he brought flowers, and he's also holding the Witchblade in his hand, which causes Sarah a little bit of distress. He notices the expression on her face and said, "Oh, you noticed this thing. Found out the crime scene on your chest. Not sure where it is, what it is." And Sarah just kind of coughs and blows it off. What I find strange about that, like, why would you take a piece of evidence with you? Like, he came directly from the crime scene, bought flowers, and didn't have it. I mean, that's not a thing, right? That would not happen. But anyway, just to kind of give it some context. And we also see that Nottingham is there at the hospital keeping an eye on her. Clearly, Irons has some interest in her because she was able to wield the Witchblade. So that night, Sarah, she's actually healing really fast, much faster than she expects. And she just feels like she has to get out of the hospital, so she leaves. There's a montage page by Michael Turner that really shows the strength of his art. And then we switch to the scene at a restaurant. Nottingham is there with Kenneth Irons and another one of Irons' associates. A man from the Yakuza shows up, an assassin, tries to kill Irons. And there's a really cool scene sitting at the table. Nottingham's pretty much motionless. This Yakuza assassin walks right up, fires at Kenneth Irons right in the face. And Nottingham, pretty much motionless except for his arm, just reaches out and catches the bullet. And Irons says, "You may retaliate now." So the Yakuza assassin's clearly taken aback by this and tries to run away, goes and gets in a car. And there's a really cool double page spread where Nottingham leaps the car as the Yakuza assassin is attempting to run him over and basically splits the car in half with this sword that he has, killing the driver. So that's a really, really cool scene. Next, we see that Sarah actually goes home and we meet her friend's daughter, the friend that got killed. Clearly, it's been a while. And we can tell that they're really close, and it's Sarah's become much like a surrogate mother to her. Then, even though she's still hurt and hasn't fully recovered, she heads down to the precinct. And even though it's in the middle of the night, 2 a.m., we see the internal affairs person still there, still being scuzzy, wanting to ask Sarah questions, but she says later. She goes into the evidence room. She finds the Witchblade. And then the scene shifts to Kenneth Irons. And he's in front of some kind of a brazier. Not sure. Just talks about spending the whole day in a ritual. So it's unclear what exactly is going on there. But in the meantime, Sarah goes to the morgue with the Witchblade. And she apparently has some idea that she can use the power of the Witchblade to bring Michael Yee back. And interspersed in those panels, we see Nottingham kneeling, and we find out this ritual that Kenneth Irons is about to perform, he's branding the back of Nottingham's wrist with some circles, and those circles are in the same pattern as the gems on the Witchblade gauntlet. So clearly there's some connection there. And as Sarah pulls out the drawer where Michael Yee's body is, she's holding the Witchblade and she's kind of comes to her senses. What am I doing? I guess I can't do anything right. And she turns away from Michael's body. And unbeknownst to her, he's actually sitting up. So clearly the Witchblade has some power over death, maybe. So again, a strong story. There wasn't a lot in the second issue that stood out to me like there was in the first issue with Sarah's ability to fight without the Witchblade. Like we see even before she obtains the Witchblade that she's has some pretty good fighting skills. I think all the big beats that were in this issue I noticed the first time around, except I don't know that it bothered me that Jake had the gauntlet in her hospital room. I don't know if I noticed that the first time, just that how strange that would be. But another solid issue, you know, great art from Michael Turner, interesting page layouts. The really cool moments in the issue are the same ones that I noticed the first time around. Nottingham catching that bullet is a really, really cool scene. And then him splitting the car in half is also another cool one. The full page spread of Nottingham in his kind of armor with the brand now on the back of his hand is an incredible image. So much detail in Michael Turner's art. Really amazing. So I feel like this issue was a necessary issue as far as establishing that clearly there's some connection between Irons and Nottingham and the Witchblade, but it didn't necessarily move the story forward a whole lot. It's almost like an aftermath issue from the events of the first issue. So let's move on to issue three. Oh, well, before I move on to issue three, I should give the creative team for issue two, which actually is the kind of the first or the same as issue one. So we have David Wall as the scripter with Brian Haberlin, and then Michael Turner, D-Tron on inks, and J.D. Smith on colors. So let's move on to issue three. And we have David Wall as scripter with Michael Turner on pencils. We have D-Tron on inks once again, and J.D. Smith on colors. So we've lost Brian Haberlin, basically. So this issue picks up right where issue two left off. Sarah's in the morgue. She turns around. Before she even turns around, Michael Yee, who is dead, but is sitting upright and makes some kind of blow sound, and Sarah turns around. She's like totally shocked. Horrified. No, this isn't happening. This isn't real. She's hallucinating. She tries to talk to him. Mike, are you alive? And she kind of gets over her initial shock and gives him a hug and says, "Oh, you're so cold. Come on, we got to get you out of here. I know a place we can go. We'll get you home to rest." And Michael's response is, "Kill me." And she says, "There's no pulse. He's alive, but not really. What did this thing do to him?" And then before she can do anything, he kind of convulses. And Sarah says, "No, you can't. Not again." And he's basically dead. So she's pretty horrified by these events. And she walks out to the crematorium in the morgue and throws the Witchblade into the incinerator, and then as she leaves the room, and we can see again as she removes it, it's kind of scrapes her forearm, but as she leaves the crematorium, we see that Seltzer, the Eternal Affairs officer, is sneaking into the room behind her. So Sarah takes a cab home, and she's kind of thinking about what the heck the Witchblade is, how it was able to raise the dead, how it left scratches on her when she was trying to take it off, and she's just trying to process everything that's happened to her when there's a knock at the door. And it's Lisa, and she's kind of saying, congratulating Sarah, hey, the guy that killed my mom, they got him. And she's really happy about that and wonders if Sarah will go to a concert with her that night to celebrate, but Sarah says that she can't. And then before anything else can happen or the two of them can talk it out, Jake shows up and says, you know, here you are laying around. I mean, he's joking, but he says, here you are laying around. There's a serial killer out there. He struck again, and I'm hearing about this date. And, he's totally joking, but Sarah just flips out. And she says she didn't know she had to run her whole agenda by him. And he's like, hey, I'm sorry. And she grabs her gym bag and leaves, slamming the door behind her. So next she's at a gym. She's working out on the heavy bag. And Kenneth Iron shows up to hold the bag for her. And he basically introduces himself. And she's says, oh, wow, I'm sorry, I didn't. You know, you're the one that sent me flowers when I was in the hospital, and I'm not sure why you're here, but she feels bad for kind of telling him to buzz off when he first shows up, but he gives her his number, and then Sarah's walking home. There's a limo, and we see that the guy in the passenger seat is the third gentleman that was with Irons in Nottingham at the restaurant when the Yakuza tried to assassinate him. And he asks about a phone. And Sarah's response is, don't you have a phone in that limo? And meanwhile, we see that he was just trying to distract her when somebody else comes out of the back of the limo and basically kidnaps her. Next, we see they take her to a boat. And these gentlemen actually have the Witchblade, the one that was, supposedly thrown in the incinerator. And they tell her to put it on. She refuses. And so they start shooting her. Shoot her in the shoulder. She starts bleeding out. She's laying there. And the Witchblade's laying on the floor next to her. And they kind of say, okay, well, you're going to put it on or you're going to bleed to death. Whatever. And this is kind of weird. They basically turn their backs to her. And now, clearly these guys are in the employ of Kenneth Irons. And maybe he just kept them in the dark about what Sarah was capable of doing when she had the Witchblade, but it seems strange that they would leave her in proximity to the Witchblade and turn their backs on her, because sure enough, even though she doesn't want to, she doesn't really have a choice, and she embraces the Witchblade. She puts it on again and then proceeds to kind of kick their butts. But they do have a lot of guns and start shooting at her. She jumps out of the boat, swims to Liberty Island, actually, and the men chase in a rubber lifeboat. And we see Sarah there. She's on the island, and we see that the Witchblade has started to talk to her. She says, you're driving me crazy. All you're doing is talking to me. She manages to subdue two of the men that are chasing her, but then Nottingham drops down from a helicopter above. And that's the way the third issue ends. So again, this issue's a lot of action, which is great. And the art is amazing, as always, from Michael Turner. But because it's so heavy on action, again, there's not a lot that I noticed on the second read through that I didn't get the first time. It's pretty standard. We're well into the story now. And now that the Witchblade has started to try to communicate with Sarah and actually talk to her, it's added another layer to the story. So let's move on to issue 4. So we have David Wall on plots, David Wall and Christina Z on script, Michael Turner on pencils, D-Tron on inks, and J.D. Smith on the colors. So again, issue 4, Well, actually, issue 4 doesn't pick up where issue 3 left off. I thought it did. But first, we see that Jake is at the gym where Sarah was working out, trying to find out where she is because she hasn't shown up. She's missing. You know, we know that she got kidnapped off the street by those two guys in the limo. And nobody is quite sure where she is, but clearly Jake is looking for her. Then on the next page, it picks up where the previous issue 3 left off, and Nottingham and Sarah are fighting on Liberty Island. And Sarah seems to be holding her own somewhat, but again, as good of a fighter as she was without the Witchblade, and she's a better fighter with it, Nottingham is like a master assassin. So he does get the upper hand on her. And I'm not sure if he would actually hurt her or choke her or break her neck as he is threatening to do. But he does get the upper hand on her and tells her that she has a beautiful neck and that breaking it would be far too easy. And he wants to actually make her suffer first. Then we have an interlude. We see Lisa's at the police station. She's looking for Sarah. Seltzer kind of makes some inappropriate comments and seems like he wants to ask her out when the captain comes over and kind of shoos him off and asks if he can help Lisa with anything. And I think Lisa's just weirded out and's like, nah, I'm good, I'm leaving. So then we head back to the Statue of Liberty, Liberty Island, where Nottingham has basically Sarah in a chokehold when someone attacks Nottingham from behind. And lo and behold, surprise, surprise, it's actually Kenneth Irons who frees her from Nottingham. And then we see him whisper to Nottingham that I gotta make her trust me. I gotta make her think that we're not together. So that's why I'm saving her. And he kind of proceeds to beat the crap out of Nottingham while telling Sarah to run away. So Sarah runs, she hides. Kenneth Irons shows up around the corner where she is and says, "You're in shock. You know, come with me, I'll keep you safe." And she's like, "Nah, I gotta go." And then elsewhere on the next page, we see a mysterious robed and hooded figure going to the Rialto Theater. He's talking about sensing something that's so close. "I know you were here, I'm following your tracks." So clearly somebody who's hunting down the Witchblade. Next scene is Jake's apartment. Sarah shows up. She looks like she's in pretty bad shape from her fight. Bruises are starting to show on her face. And Jake's like, "Wow, were you in an accident? Someone do that to you? Who hurt you?" And Sarah's kind of like, "You know, it's nothing to be concerned about. I can handle it. I just need to crash for a while." And he kind of gives her a look like, not a welcoming look, I'll put it that way. And Sarah says, "Fine, forget it. I'm going." And Jake thinks better of it. You know, his face kind of softens. Says, "No, Sarah, it's fine. Please come in. Please stay." And she just wants to sleep. And so she goes to his bedroom. She falls asleep actually with the Witchblade on while Jake sleeps out on the couch. And she has some pretty vivid dreams. The Witchblade kind of manifests again. And one thing that I haven't mentioned about the Witchblade, I'm sure a lot of you people or a lot of you listeners know this, but you know, it's a gauntlet that you put on, but once Sarah puts it on, tendrils of some kind of something come out of it and form armor, and that's what actually her costume is. But we haven't really seen it like fully form and give her like full armor yet up until this point. But on the final page of this issue, where we see Kenneth Irons standing in the background, somehow he's managed to sneak into Jake's apartment, and he's standing there back to the window, lightning crashing in the background, and the Witchblade has Sarah, you know, 100% enveloped. Pretty much all you can see is parts of her face that are uncovered. Otherwise, she's completely covered in this kind of bio armor that the Witchblade has created, almost like a cocoon. And it's the first time since the story started in these first 4 issues where we see that the Witchblade really could be sinister, I guess you'd say, and could really have a mind of its own and clearly is more than what it seems. I mean, at this point, if you know nothing about the Witchblade, you almost could think that it would take her over or transform her in such a way. I mean, that's how crazy this final splash page is of her completely covered. So again, it's the first half of the issue is a lot of action. Second half, we're kind of moving the plot along. The introduction of this hooded figure who seems to be searching for the Witchblade is an interesting plot point. The whole dynamic between Irons and Nottingham, we're starting to see it's not just master-servant kind of thing. There's clearly a lot of other dynamics in play there. Turner's art continues to be fantastic. But again, much like issue 2 and 3, there wasn't a whole lot that in this issue that I didn't notice or comment on the first time around. So I'm not going to drag this out any further. We're probably going to call it a day. But again, I'll just say to repeat what I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast. I feel like this is a really strong story, a classic mid-90s story that was probably some of the better storytelling that came out of that era. I know that era gets a kind of a bad rap sometimes, you know, because of the crash and of the mid-90s and whatnot. But there were a lot of good comics that were produced during that time. I know things like Spider-Man's Clone Saga get a bad rap because it, you know, went dragged on for so long and people really didn't like it at the time and such. And, you know, just like I think that Witchblade gets a bad rap. People just think it's, you know, a bimbo in a revealing costume who, and it's not strong storytelling and it's not good storytelling. And that's simply not true. And having gone back and reread these issues again, to do this podcast, it just really showed me that without the expectations I had the first time that I read it and just kind of being a little more objective and reading it again, I really enjoyed reading the story again. It's really well paced, which is probably something that I didn't necessarily notice the first time, or maybe I may have even mentioned the first time that the pacing wasn't that good. I seem to remember that now that I think about it. But I think part of that was just being anxious to kind of get going and understand more of what the Witchblade story was all about. Now that I have more of a foundation going back and reading it, I think it is paced really well. You know, there are parts where it speeds up and parts where it slows down, which is, you know, the part of any good story. You can't have your, you know, foot down on the gas and be going 100 miles an hour the whole time. Storytelling doesn't work that way. You need the quieter moments. You need to slow down, give the story room to breathe and stuff like that. So I think that these first four issues are really strong. And like I said, the next time we do a Top Cow Chronology project, we will be talking about issues 5 through 8. So once again, I want to thank everyone for joining us. Please go to thecomicsourceblog.com for all past episodes of the podcast. Twitter.com/thecomicsource is where you can find us on Twitter to eavesdrop on all our conversations with other comic creators. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to keep up to date on our convention coverage and when new episodes are released. Also, don't forget about our exclusive podcast for LRM Online, the 9-panel grid, which comes out every Tuesday. And we are still in the process of migrating everything over. I think we've got just about everything migrated over now to LRM Online, where they'll be hosting all the Comic Source content going forward. It's just a matter of getting everything set up to produce new content and have it start appearing over there. So once again, thanks for joining us, everybody, and we'll talk to you next time.